Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Lynn Pettinger, who's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Warwick, about her new book, What's Wrong with Work, which is published by Policy Press. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Nice to talk to you.
This is a fascinating book. I think it does a couple of things that are quite rare in contemporary academic texts, which is that it takes a really important social problem that's, you know, part of the way we live now, synthesizes a whole load of quite complex and in some cases quite esoteric academic theory, but makes it really understandable and you know, makes it kind of really straightforward to read. And one of the things that struck me about the book was a question about how you came to be interested to write it and why in particular you wanted to write a book that did that synthesis and addressed this important contemporary question about what's wrong with work?
Yeah, well, in my complete academic arrogance, I came up with the title quite a while ago, and I was trying to persuade some friends that we could do an edited collection that was really an exploration of the very worst forms of work, in order to just kind of do some stuff that looked globally at work and think about why work was so bad. And I couldn't get anyone interested in that, which I think is a shame. But I had the title. And then Policy got in touch and said, are you interested in writing a book about the gig economy? Which I really wasn't interested in, because one of my big arguments about how we study work is that we tend to focus too deeply on one specific area of work. So gig economy becomes a thing that we have to do lots and lots of work on. And what gets lost there is a sense that something that seems like a new phenomenon like the gig economy has a history to it, has a geography to it, and it links to all kinds of other forms of work. So in my academic arrogance, I thought I'll do a more general book about work. And I had this title, and so a book about the ethics and politics of work as it's changing right now. And I thought it would be a fairly straightforward thing to write. Opening section, first half of the book that was about how people have thought about ethics and politics of work, a discussion of the three fields of work that I think are particularly interesting at the moment, which are environment, technology, and informal economy, and then a conclusion that said what I thought about what's wrong with work. But the more I read about it, the more I came to try to write about it, the less confident I felt with the idea that there could be an answer to that question. That the more I thought about it, the more different kinds of questions needed to come into play, I thought. So one of the dominant ways that we think about ethics and politics of work is around the treatment of workers. And this is fundamentally very, very important, because this is about what affects people's everyday experience, how they get to work in the morning, how they come home, and how they're able to live. But it didn't strike me as enough to understand the place of work within contemporary society, its relationships within global capitalism, and the parts of work that didn't reduce to an explanation that was, well, neoliberalism has changed the world of work and made it much worse. It struck me that there was something more complicated to think through there. So that was what I was trying to do.
I mean, the really obvious way to probe that sense of there being something more complicated is with your take on what we might think of as the kind of history of work. And I was particularly struck quite early on in the book, the way that you were keen to kind of say, look, we kind of need to stop talking just about good and bad work. And we need to, and again, you gestured to this, you know, historicize this and locate it in a geographic setting as well. And I suppose, you know, the key question is, so what is that understanding you developed about how we should understand that history of work?
I think I could answer that, spend a long time answering that. I think one of the really important things for me was to do some thinking about the study of work itself and ask where concepts come from. So a lot of the concepts that people use when they're thinking about work derive from industrial capitalism, from factory work in Europe, specifically in Britain. And that gives us some very, very useful ways for thinking about work. And it gets supplemented by labour process analysis, which looks also at factory work and then extends that idea from factory work to other settings. But there are all forms of work that are missed out of that. So I think if in the history of the study of work, people had taken seriously the role of slavery and colonization, thought about how slavery was really central to the development of industrial capitalism, then we would have some different kinds of concepts. If people had taken seriously the very significant numbers of people who work in domestic service work, globally, historically, in the present, and how that domestic service work is organised, then again, there'd be a different politics. So one of the things I wanted to do was to draw out those forms of work that weren't always thought about and to try to maybe redress some of the ways in which the first thing you imagine when you think about work is what it's like to do factory work. And that's not to downplay the importance of factory work, but it's to say that there are more forms of work in the world. The second thing that I was thinking about is relates to your problem about your question about geography, which also I think is a question about scale. So one of the things that we learn when we think about the work on a global scale and the global interconnections of work. And we learn this through things like, say, supply chain analysis, how different kinds of work co-depend on each other. So, and that includes the work from marketing to the consumption of different goods, the design of goods and how that affects who ends up making it. So the obvious example would be garment manufacturing and the global story about garment manufacturing, the interconnections between different kinds of places.
One of the things that's going on in there within that, I guess, kind of reorientation away from just a singular vision of a particular form of work, and you know, a changing of the territory in which that work takes place is the use of a couple of concepts that I found quite interesting, or maybe actually descriptive terms more than concepts. But this idea about particular kinds of work being deleted and invisible, I guess you've kind of gestured towards that already in terms of that sense of garment production in a global supply chain, which doesn't quite fit that, you know, Industrial Revolution, men in factories, probably in the north of England kind of vision of work. And at the same time, points us towards particular kinds of work that often aren't paid, tell us things about how we should gender our understanding of work. So deleted and invisible, I think, would be great examples to help us think about different kinds of work.
Yeah, thanks. And I think there's... I think both slavery and indentured labour should be thought of as part of those invisible kinds of work, as well as all kinds of elements of care work, domestic service work, domestic labour work, which vary in terms of how they're organised, so whether they're paid or unpaid, who pays if they are paid. But the other thing that I think often gets deleted is the kinds of work that make other work that's very visible possible. And my big example here is the technological work. So in many studies of work, technology is a really key story. It's a really important thing. So in any account of the de-skilling of work, there's an argument about the technological substitution of work. But one of the things that gets like hidden from that is the idea that technology is also made. So from my point of view, to pay more attention to, for example, what a software engineer understands about the work process he's trying to capture, and I say he deliberately because they really often very much are men, how does the software engineer understand that work process and how do they translate it into an app or whatever that substitutes or transforms the work that's being done? So, and you know, on a kind of slightly similar theme is when we talk about an architect as having built something, then we give a priority to the creative vision of what the architect has done. But anything we know about the detail of how a building gets built means that all kinds of other workers were also involved in influencing the creative production of the building, as well as how well it stands and how well made it is. So negotiations between creative workers and workers who aren't considered to be creative, that really matters to understanding what the finished product looks like. So rather than kind of prioritizing one kind of occupation, one form of work, to think about how that work relies on all kinds of other forms of work, which may not have the same status, but which nonetheless does quite a lot to produce whatever is being produced.
I mean, one of the things in there that I guess links to later on in the book is this idea about technology and the importance of objects. And I was quite struck, and this sounds a bit strange, but I was quite struck by a discussion about photocopiers in the fourth chapter, which I slightly wasn't expecting, but, you know, is reflecting, I guess, the kind of the importance of these machines in academic life. And, you know, we could talk about photocopiers perhaps, but the photocopier, I guess, is you're talking about it because you're interested in the idea of talking about invisible or deleted work and dignity, and you know how we think about, you know, good, well-paid work and dignity in one's work and one's labor. But actually, you're also kind of critical about that, and you talk about the way that, you know, recognition also comes with limits and contradictions, and there are problems, and this is one of the things that's wrong with work, to go back to the title. So I guess the question that comes from that is this thing about why are you so bothered about photocopiers?
Yeah, so the photocopier research done by Julian Orr many, many years ago, and I've always found it kind of captivating how someone can make a very mundane technology so interesting, and can show how its function and dysfunction really affects all the work that's possible around it. And it took me a while to realize that was helping me think about why I was uncomfortable with visions of dignity at work as something to aspire to. And it makes me sound really curmudgeonly, I know, because dignity is something that it's kind of impossible to be against, because who would say that human dignity is not a desirable thing? And it's not that I think that it's not a desirable thing, just that I think that there are some limits to it. And I think that when we think about good and bad jobs or what's wrong with work, and we alight on an idea like dignity, and then we see, well, what counts as dignity and what doesn't count as dignity, then we do something productive for thinking about what's wrong with work. But we do miss out on some other phenomena that I think affect what work is like and what work does in the world. So in dignity research, it seems to me that the big concern is often with the treatment of some humans by other humans, specifically how management treats its workers. So dignity is part of a hierarchical story in the workplace, which is fine, which is an important thing to say, but which isn't enough. In that traditional dignity story, technology appears as a tool of management, which also is very reasonable, but again, slightly misrepresents what technology does in the world. So if we think about photocopiers, then we get a slightly different vision of what technology and other kinds of material objects might do to interrupt work, to make work better or worse. So in a mundane example, but mundane things are often really important. If your photocopier is regularly breaking, then you cannot very easily do the work that you're trying to do. So a technological failure is a problem, and that gets in the way of you being able to reach targets and things like that. In a different example, where I also think material objects are powerful, or materiality is powerful, if you're someone whose job it is to repair potholes in the road, for example, then how you do that work, what that work feels like, but also what you have to do a good job, is really affected by the materiality of the world around you, most obviously by weather and by seasons. So potholes come when water freezes and generates cracks in tarmac. So changeable weather means that there is more demand for what you're doing, and it means that your repairs have got to be better if they're to last. So there's a whole question about like the quality of the work that you do, perhaps even a sense in which you can feel like you've done good work, that's really influenced by the place of that kind of work within the world that surrounds it. So it's not that I think dignity is problematic, but I think in its overwhelming focus on human primacy and the human experience, it really misses out something about the location of human life within nature and culture.
I mean, that the other side to, I guess, kind of locating work are things that are relational. And one thing we sort of haven't got to yet, but is absolutely crucial, are things like contractual relationships and the organization of work. And I think we could probably extend actually the discussion you've already had about seasonality, about materiality, into questions about how is work managed? What kinds of organization do we have? How should we think about, you know, kind of contemporary work contracts, both as a way of thinking about dignity in work and its limits, but also as a way of connecting us to, I guess, really kind of bigger theories about contemporary capitalism. You sort of open up a discussion of neoliberalism later on in the sort of the middle part of the book. And it'd be interesting to kind of think through and understand how it is management, temping, contracts tell us both about the experience of work, but also about how we're organizing society.
Yeah, big questions for sure. I'm going to answer it in a way that's kind of the opposite of what you asked, which is to talk about the limits of what a big concept like neoliberalism can do to help us to understand those kind of phenomena. So precariousness, increasing use of temp workers, or those kinds of things. Because it strikes me that if a researcher or a writer or someone making an argument rushes very readily to say, oh, well, it's neoliberalism, then I think that is both a flattening of the complexity of differences in the world, a flattening of history, and it generates a sense of hopelessness. Because how can you be against, how can you possibly like engage with, address something that's kind of so all-consuming? And I think neoliberalism as a way of providing explanations for what's wrong with the world right now, including what's wrong with work, can tend to just limit a little bit too much that sense in which some of the phenomena that we explain in the contemporary world as being about neoliberalism as having other drivers. So it's a kind of an economy first explanation, something that I refer to using ideas from J.K. Gibson Graham around capitalocentrism, that it assumes there's no world that is not reducible to an economic explanation, no form of life that's escapable, is able to escape or has ever escaped from this all-consuming explanation. And that just means that we don't pay enough attention to how policies that might be appropriately described as neoliberalism are applied differently in different places, and how so many of the things that drive towards precarious work pre-exist neoliberalism. So if you pay attention to informal economic activity, for example, this has a really, really long history. And precarious life is has an extraordinary long historical scope. To say that precariousness is can be explained through neoliberalism is to miss out on those that history and those differences, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that in contemporary discussions of work, you've highlighted that precariousness is one of those things that is, you know, really kind of key. And we've seen discussions in the literature about, you know, the formation of maybe, you know, a new class and a new form of class consciousness around precariousness and a precariat, perhaps. And historicizing this stuff, I think, is crucial, as you point out. I think the other thing going on with that maybe cautionary tale about a grand social theory and the need to understand differences as much as the kind of continuities with something like neoliberalism is the way the book shifts, and to coin a cliche, it's sort of a book of two halves. And I'm interested to know how you sort of decided on that kind of split. And I suppose a more, if I might call it, a kind of case study approach in the second half of the book.
Yeah. So I call it knots rather than case studies, because one of the things I wanted to pay attention to is the interconnections between the three things that I focused on in the second part of the book. So they are environment, technology, and the informal economy. So, you know, it's a way to properly think through the implications of my own reasoning around complexity, to try to hold on to and recognize that complexity and then think with it. So that would be in the case of, say, the relationships between technology and informal economic activity, to think through a phenomenon like the gig economy that we started off with, which is also a way of thinking through gender relationships in work. So a lot of the conversation at the moment about the gig economy treats technology as an inevitability. It's just a given. We live with it. And it finds the gig economy to be problematic. And indeed, it is problematic. But it's not quite as new as people think. And the versions of the gig economy that I see being researched at the moment are very often, let's say, perhaps being, okay, misapportion blame here. But I think sometimes when I read stuff about the gig economy, I think, well, women have been doing de facto gig work for a really, really long time, doing rubbish cleaning jobs, being uncertain about what their future is, being sent by their employers from place to place. And that wasn't, there was no like upsurge of research around that in the way that there has been now that young white men are doing a Deliveroo. And so I think there's a little politics around how questions come to be important at particular times and particular places.
I mean, the really obvious example is in your discussion of craft and fashion, which I found particularly useful, actually, because obviously, you know, we think of fashion and craft as being part of, you know, maybe a creative economy, part of an emerging, you know, in some ways kind of like almost sort of post-industrial form of economic organization, where narratives of the craft production and parts of the fashion industry are to do with, you know, bespoke individual craftspeople, often enabled through websites like Etsy to, you know, sell almost peer-to-peer and stuff like this. And you kind of say, well, actually, you know, we need to think about measurements. We need to think about what's going on, you know, how are our understandings of these forms of working activity, you know, even brought into being. And I guess that's a kind of an extension of the gendering you've sought to do with the gig economy.
Yeah. And the other thing I think about when we think about something like craft and fashion clothing is the interplay between unpaid work or forms of socialization in the home and getting paid work. So to get a job at a garment factory in a special economic zone, probably a poorly paid job, probably one where you have to work very long hours in very unpleasant conditions, you already have to know how to sew, because they're not going to do on-the-job training. So this is about women training other women in how to sew in order to be able to get involved in those forms of what we call adversely incorporated employment. I always thought that clothing is really good to think with when we're trying to understand the interconnections between different forms of work. But I also think in relation to your question about craft and fashion and the kind of creative elements to it, it's about foregrounding the capacity of bodies. And the example I like a little more than the example of craft and fashion is an example from a paper I heard from a guy called Mark Egan, and he never published it, which is a shame because I think it's such a fantastic thing to say, is if you're an aerospace engineer or, your job is designing features of spacecraft, you can have extraordinary knowledge and competency and a great craftability to do craft. Craftability is a new word. Let's use that in future. But you can be in the state right at the moment, at the time when you're finishing a project, let's say, of being incredibly nervous about putting the finishing touches, because it's actually a nimble fingers job as well as a deeply skilled job which requires a lot of training and intelligence. So the state of being competent but not being competent right now strikes me as a really interesting way to think about what it is to do work. And I think about that myself very, very often when I'm struggling to find the way to, write a sentence, finish a chapter or something like that, that there's more contingency to our capacity to do work. I think this takes us back to the ideas around repair and what the photocopier person is doing. The photocopier needs quite a skilled manipulation with an object to be able to do what they do.
We have to be sort of quite careful, not to miss some of the kind of key things in the book, actually. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff I'd like to talk to you about, things like bodies, and you talk in detail about healthcare and the relationship between technology and health, which obviously picks up on many of the themes we've already discussed about hidden deleted labor, about the need to think about the kind of histories of work as almost as histories of bodies. But one of the things that really comes through at the very end of the book is a discussion about the environmental crisis. We're at a moment, at least here in the UK, in London, of protests, interventions around the environmental crisis. And one of the questions that kind of struck me was the idea of a green job's even possible. Is it possible to do a greening of the economy, a greening of work? Is it possible to make the way we've organized work and our support structures like unions green? And indeed, as you go on in that chapter to think about, is it possible to kind of understand the very understanding we have about an environmental crisis as work itself? And I think that's a really kind of crucial topic, both for the sake of humanity, but also immediately, in the moment we find ourselves right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great that there is such an upsurge of conversation around the prospects of a transformation in how we think about environment. There has been a longer kind of technocratic story about the prospect of a Green New Deal, about the prospect of greening jobs, which is referred to as the triple win: good for society, good for economy, and good for environment. But it's a version of business as usual. It's, making things a bit better. So it's greening car production rather than asking questions around whether so many new cars need to be produced. And there's always a kind of a little bit of a nod to the idea that technology will save us. So geoengineering will save us by providing better ways in which we can combat changes in the weather systems, for example. And very often this is based on, I think, a claim that there's a solution to problems, which is not necessarily that the solution being promised is the desirable solution. So it has to be a different kind of conversation about what might a less environmentally destructive way of living look like? And so the prospect of green jobs is, the answer is always, well, the devil is in the detail as to what that looks like. Greening car production, which has been a conversation happening among car firms, but also that there's been some research around, is one way to think about that. But it returns the focus to factory work, to the production of consumer goods. Other conversations about green work are around kind of retrofitting systems that we have already, so making our energy production more environmentally friendly. And in some circles, it's around doing less work, making less stuff, getting rid of forms of work. So this is a debate around post-work, which I don't particularly discuss very much in the book, partly because I'm often a little bit shy about following utopian thinking and a bit unconvinced by that. There's a kind of innate cynicism to how I think about the world. And partly because sometimes the idea about having less work is based on an assumption, on a problematic assumption about what work we mean when we talk about less work. So still forms of gendered and racialized forms of care work don't get removed when we talk about less work, doing less work as a way of greening the economy. But as is so often the case for how I think, is I don't find quick answers, because I just don't think that there are quick answers to the problem of greening the economy, nor to the problem of technological transformation of the economy, nor to the persistence of poor forms of informal work.
And I think that's where the book is particularly strong, is the sense of, you know, we really need thinking about these subjects, and, you know, the whether we'd call it, you know, solutionism or, you know, a kind of technological utopianism, these things we need to treat with, you know, quite serious caution, because they're likely to replicate the issues that we've seen in the history of work that, you know, have kind of come to us with a very long standing set of structural inequalities. Now, this would be the point where I'd usually ask my guests, you know, what are you working on now? What kind of, you know, ideas have you got for future work? But I think it's really important we talk about James Bond to finish.
Yeah, always.
And I'm just really interested in the conclusion to the book, where you talk about the man with the golden gun, which, if, you know, listeners are unfamiliar with, is, it's a, you know, a Roger Moore James Bond film, and I assume it was an Ian Fleming book as well. The film has aged quite badly, I'd say.
As many of them have, yeah.
So what does The Man with the Golden Gun tell us about, I guess, how you've answered the three questions that the book is interested in?
Yeah, so in the kind of showdown of The Man with the Golden Gun, James Bond goes to The Man with the Golden Gun, Francisco Scaramanga's island, to have the shootout, effectively. But he's gets captured in a hall of mirrors, and there are all kinds of models of Scaramanga, and he's shooting at the wrong person. I came up with this as a way to think through the problems I found in writing a conclusion, solely because at this point of writing the book, I was exhausted and my cultural references were getting smaller and smaller, and I was going for easier and easier things to read and to watch. I'm not sure that James Bond is a productive source of theorizing more generally. But the reason why the kind of imagery of the Hall of Mirrors captured me is that, so I don't think I wrote a conclusion. I think I wrote a final chapter, because the more I was thinking about these questions, the less I felt confident that there could be a solution or could be a simple answer. One of the things that a conclusion is often doing is having spent a whole book talking about how complicated the world is, to then come back and say, well, but nonetheless, here are my bullet point solutions. And I feel like in the study of what's wrong with work, there have been many, many kind of attempts to provide bullet point solutions to complicated problems. We see this in the ideas of the ILO indecent work. We see it in some of the ideas about dignity work. And it's not that those aren't important, and it's not that they don't do something good. But as soon as you kind of have that bullet point list of things to aspire to, you've got rid of the complexity of the interconnections between greening work and technological change, for example. You've got rid of so much of the really difficult opening up of the question that the rest of the book had done. And I was struck by something from Isabel Stengers, which is that answers aren't found in books. In academic books, answers that get found in practices. So what I hope my book is trying to do, or does for people who read it, is to draw attention to the complexity of the problem, to ask questions in a different way, to put phenomena together and connect them in different ways, to draw on the kind of esoteric ideas that you mentioned at the start, in ways that perhaps produce different thoughts for other people, rather than feel like in my final chapter, I conclude by tidying all the complexity that I've paid so much attention to and done so much work to make clear.